Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. Glad to have you listening. My name is David Inge. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. We'd like to thank everyone who helped us meet our goal during our winter membership campaign. 873 listeners contributed a total of $100,341 to WILL Radio during the past week, that is last week. And we'd also like to welcome particularly the 183 new members to the Friends of WILL. Your pledges of support will help us fulfill our pledge to provide you with the best possible programs and services in the coming year. So again, we want to say to you, thank you very much. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about a little bit about graduate education here in the United States, something that, of course, is an important subject to people at this university and also to colleges and universities across the country. And we'll be talking a little bit about what it is we know about people who go to graduate school, particularly people who are pursuing doctoral degrees, why it is they're going, what it is they think that they're going to get out of the experience, and indeed whether the experience is what they thought it would be. Did it provide them what they wanted? Did it do what they wanted in terms of career for them? And perhaps also, would they, if they had it to do over again, would they? Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Chris Goldie. She is a senior scholar at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, where she is research director for the Carnegie Initiative on the Doctorate. And for the last 10 years, her research has indeed been focusing on doctoral education, particularly on the experiences of doctoral students. Her dissertation work, in fact, was on doctoral student attrition, and she is the lead author of At Cross Purposes, What the Experiences of Today's Doctoral Students Reveal About Doctoral Education. That was a report that came out in 2001, a report of the National Survey on Doctoral Education and Career Preparation funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. She is also the co-editor with George Walker of a book titled Envisioning the Future of Doctoral Education, Preparing Stewards of the Discipline, and that was published just late in 2005. She is going to be here on the U of I campus. In fact, she's going to be giving the keynote address for a symposium titled Journeys in Graduate Study, Exploring Ways to Improve the Graduate Student Experience. And this is something to which all faculty, grad students, staff, and alumni are all invited. It is free. And if you're interested in getting information about the program, you can go to the Grad College website, and they're the sponsor, the Illinois Graduate College. That's www.grad.uiuc.edu. And this is going to be taking place Monday of next week. That's February 20th from 1 to 5 in the afternoon at the Illini Union on the U of I campus. So again, if you're interested in more information, you can go to www.grad.uiuc.edu. And here this morning as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that it means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and calls on us, 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, which may or may not make it any easier, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Dr. Goldie, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Appreciate it. I suppose the place to start, and certainly it would be something that would concern colleges and universities that offer advanced degrees, is to talk a little bit about, acknowledge the fact that a significant number of people who start out working on PhD never finish.
It's true, and it's quite a surprising piece of information, I think. We are very used to our colleges and universities being extremely effective and successful at what they do, particularly at the very elite levels of professional school and highly selective colleges and universities. And yet, when it comes to doctoral study, the best that we know is that about half the students who start don't actually complete the degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder how you go about evaluating something like that, because I'm sure that there you would have to expect there would be some natural attrition for some number of reasons. People would go into it, and we're going to talk some more about the survey that you were involved in and what people said, but I'm sure that people do go into it, and for a number of reasons, maybe it's not what they thought it was going to be, it wasn't what they wanted, for a variety of reasons. So I guess the question would be, what would be an acceptable or an expected kind of attrition level?
It's a great question, because I think you're really pointing out that there might be good attrition and bad attrition. And so the question really is, why do people leave, and when do they leave, and under what circumstances, and sort of what are the conditions that foster success or hinder success? And I mean, that's, I guess I'm paraphrasing your question there. I think what troubles me is when students linger on in a program for years and years and years and don't get a lot of good feedback and find themselves 7 or 8 years along and without a lot of support and guidance. And at that point, maybe discouragement sets in and they're experiencing a lot of debt and then they choose to leave. And I think that most of us would agree that's sort of the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
On the other hand, just sort of set up some counterpoints here. A student who comes into graduate school, genuine passion, and in the first year says, wow, I thought I knew what it meant to be a historian, but I'm finding myself sitting in the bottom of the library, poring over microfiche, and I'm talking to the books, and they're not talking back to me, and boy, that's just not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And they talk to the other faculty and the other students, and it becomes clear that they have a pretty accurate vision of the life sort of in front of them, and realize that just doesn't suit their skill set or their passions and desires, and make the decision to leave. And I think that, we might all agree, is really a good case scenario. And so I think the really important question is how to make the system both as supportive for student success as possible. How can programs be structured and people think about the process in ways that really sort of kind of foster conditions for success and for making decisions at an early point based on good information? And how can we make the system transparent so students don't come to graduate school with one set of expectations and find that their expectations are not met, or that they were entirely naive and misguided because they didn't ask the right questions and didn't really know what questions to ask, and the whole thing was really just kind of a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I suppose it invites a question, and I'm sure obviously making generalizations is difficult, but I suppose, again, it sort of depends on who you ask. But if you do ask this question, generally speaking, to the extent that it's possible to answer this question, generally speaking, if you ask, what's the problem? Is it the problem of the student? Or is it the problem essentially the way that graduate education or the specific programs that the student are in are structured? And so is it ultimately that the person can't make it? And I suppose there are some people who would say, well, maybe they shouldn't have been in there in the first place. Or is it that we have an able student who is motivated, who is interested, and something in the process somewhere along the road just sort of turned them off? And it's not that they couldn't do it, but it's the nature of the beast that's the problem,
right,
and not the person.
Well, I tend to think it's the latter. I tend to think that a lot of the responsibility, I guess, for attrition does reside with the structures of the program and of graduate school. To the extent that we have evidence about student talent, we know that the students who leave and the students who complete look pretty much the same in terms of their undergraduate GPAs and their GRE scores. Now, we can all sit and debate whether those are really good measures of talent, but to the extent that we have those as our measures, there's not a lot of difference.
Hmm.
And so I would argue that it's really probably we need to be looking at the structure. And I guess I think about it this way. So attrition is really a symptom. So if you have a program with a high attrition rate, suppose 60% of your students don't complete, and that's a pretty constant and consistent pattern. It's not a funny off year, but it's a consistent pattern. Then I think you have a responsibility to ask the question, what's going on? Who's leaving and why are they leaving? And I think you know, it matters not for a couple of reasons. It's really important. And one is, you know, that's a lot of wasted resources for the students who don't complete, wasted resources of the federal government, of the university, of the state government, of those individuals and their families, of course. Lots of people's time have been invested on all sides of the equation. But I think even more, I think it's really important to ask the question, what's going on that's so dire that's causing those students to leave? And what's the impact of those same set of circumstances on the students who do persist? I think you could really make a case that some people get so sick that it's fatal, and others may simply just end up kind of, I mean, not to be too dramatic here, crippled by that experience. So if some people are leaving because they just can't stand the politics in the department and the sense of isolation and abandonment, other people stay, but they may end up themselves then as advisors who aren't very effective or teachers who are disgruntled or bitter. And I don't think that serves anybody at all.
Okay. Well, we have a caller already to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone here on the campus, on line number one. Hello.
Yeah. What about ABD, all but disrepresentation? What percentage is that?
That's a great question. I think there's a kind of a common stereotype that most of the people who don't complete their degrees have gone really far in the process and are kind of stuck at this ABD stage, and then they just kind of lack the motivation or the will or the stick-to-itiveness or whatever to complete. To the extent that we have sort of national data on when people leave, it kind of seems that about a third of the students leave in the first year, about another third leave in the middle couple years, and it's only about a third that leave at the much later stages. That said, when you look at the data department by department, there's really wild fluctuations, and I think you're asking a really good question, which is not only who leaves and why do they leave, but when? And I think those are the three big questions to be asking diagnostically.
What about also by discipline? You're saying departments. Is there certain, for example, engineering, do they tend to complete? And maybe in terms of liberal arts and sciences, or maybe English or whatever, don't tend?
I'm curious what your field is. Do you want to tell us?
Communications, actually, research.
It really seems to be the case that in general the highest completion rates are in the sciences, and then the social sciences are kind of in the middle, and the humanities have the lowest completion rates. Now, I think there's a couple of explanations for that. One, the time to degree is also longest in the humanities for a variety of reasons that we can talk about. And the job market is not what people like it to be in the humanities. It looks pretty dire, and most people in the humanities are really focused on becoming faculty members and don't recognize sort of a wide range of career possibilities, so that's all quite discouraging. And finally, I think as we discussed already, the isolation in the humanities when you're sort of, you know, again, to sort of draw a stereotype, sitting alone in the library, you know, or the coffee house week after week trying to write prose is quite different than being in an engineering or a chemistry laboratory where you have a lot of people around you constantly giving you feedback and encouragement and helping you through the rough spots.
But also sometimes in the engineering area, because these people are doing research, you know, under faculty and stuff, sometimes those programs are extended too.
That's true. I mean, I think that the funding questions cut both ways, and so you've just sort of reflected a really kind of a negative view of that. So you're on a funded research project, and your advisor may think, wow, you're the person who knows how to work this complicated piece of equipment. I'm not going to let him graduate because he's too valuable to me. And I think that's extremely problematic. But at the same time, there is a pretty consistent source of funding and an intellectual community that helps you through. Another way that this is sort of interesting is that in the sciences where a lot of students are funded and are on federal research projects, they may not have opportunities to really define their own research projects, which is much more common in the social sciences and the humanities, where you really are inventing your set of questions and your intellectual niche by yourself and from scratch. And so while that's very daunting, you really have learned a set of skills about inquiry that sometimes is much more difficult because there's fewer opportunities to practice in the sciences. So a lot of these things sort of have two faces.
Now, the other point, just the final point, is that that process, and I actually got involved in that, is that that can be lengthy too, you know, where you're actually discovering yourself what direction, then you have to get accepted by committees and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
and then all of a sudden one of your faculty members go off to someplace else, you know, take a position someplace else, and then, you know, then you got to be find somebody else that will fill in. So anyway, very informative.
All of those things are great points. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call. I think probably I should introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Dr. Chris Goldie. She is senior scholar at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, where she is research director for the Carnegie Initiative on the Doctorate. And for the last 10 years, she's been doing research on doctoral education, particularly the experiences of doctoral students. Her dissertation work was on doctoral student attrition, and she's also the lead author of a report that came out in 2001 titled At Cross Purposes, What the Experiences of Today's Doctoral Students Reveal About Doctoral Education. And this was a survey that looked at over 4,000 students, at least over 4,000 completed the survey. They were from 27 different universities, one cross-institutional program, and represented 11 arts and sciences disciplines. So you try to cast your net pretty broad as you possibly could. And I think what's really interesting and striking of all of the things that you found, your two major bottom lines were, one is that a lot of people said that the training that they received, the doctoral training they received, was not what they wanted. They felt that it didn't prepare them for the jobs that they take. And secondly, many students apparently don't really know what being a doctoral student is about, or at least they get into it and they say, gee, this isn't really what I thought it was going to be, and perhaps also could use help in getting in navigating the system. And I guess one of the things that I wonder about is, can it really, if you've been an undergraduate, and maybe also if you've done a master's degree, can it really be, can being a doctoral student really be such foreign territory? I wouldn't think that it would be all that different.
Well, there's a really important way in which it's different, and then we can talk about how people can kind of get a window into that. But one of the really important ways it's different is, in general, when you think about undergraduate, and I think to a large extent master's degrees as well, there's a pretty clear set of expectations and requirements. And that usually is some version of complete X number of courses. Now, there may be distribution requirements and a certain number in the major and so forth. And I think we all know after 16 years in the educational system what it means to complete a course. You have a certain set of assignments, and you complete them to satisfaction, and then you kind of check that off. And so if you've done that satisfactorily, then lo and behold, you get to go to graduation and get your degree. Doctoral education is really quite a different enterprise, because you're not simply kind of learning a whole set or body of material. You're really learning how to create new information. So you're really adopting an identity and learning a set of practices. And so there may be some requirements, like you may have to complete 6 or 8 or 10 courses, and there may be certain exams or other hurdles, but those are really all in service of you learning a set of skills and practices and really becoming a chemist or a historian or a mathematician or a neuroscientist. And that's really quite a different thing, because you're learning a lot of information, but you're also learning how to ask questions. You're learning what constitutes making a claim and having evidence for it and being able to convince others. You're learning how to communicate and teach in all kinds of settings, whether that's a classroom setting or explaining to your parents what you're doing and what this complicated thing is, or explaining to the community the importance of this work and what its relevance is for public policy. So there's really a whole lot of set of experiences and expectations, and a lot of those are evaluated in kind of informal ways. It's sort of does she have what it takes? Wow, she's really, really asking terrific questions and providing great insights and is very creative. And that's a very different way of being judged and evaluated, and it's a real shift it's really an entry into a professional community. And to that extent, I think it's really quite different than being an undergraduate.
One real quick question, then I'm going to get back to the phones here and people who are calling in. Just sort of as an overall kind of a read, again, it's a kind of a sweeping generalization, but if you ask people, you know, given the fact that it can be really difficult and that people can have problems in it, maybe it turns out to be not what they thought. Though if you said to someone, okay, if you had it to do all over again, would you do it again? How many people say Yes, I would.
Most would.
Most would.
Most would do it over again. They might make some significant changes. They might do it at a different university. They might have a different advisor. They might even have a different subfield of inquiry. But most people would do it again. And when you talk to the people who leave their programs without a degree, most of them don't express a lot of regrets, at least the ones in the interview project I did that I was able to find. Now, maybe the most bitter and disenfranchised were unreachable. But many say that they learned a lot, they're glad they did it, they're glad they know this was not the right road for them. Hmm. And clearly, if you can make that decision early, that leads to sort of a better sense of that.
Hmm. Well, and I want to get on some other calls here. Maybe I would mention just very quickly for people who are interested in looking at this report, probably many ways that people can do it, but maybe the easiest way is what I did was go to Chris Goldie's webpage. Just you put her name in your browser, and that's her last name is spelled with an E, so G-O-L-D-E, and that way you can take a look at the report and also some other information all around this particular
The report subject. URL is www.phd-survey.org.
Oh, okay. Well, that may be easier. Okay, hyphen PhD.
Hyphen survey.
Okay.
Takes you right to the report.
Good. Oh, okay. Very good. More direct. More direct is good. Let's go to someone here in Paxton on a cell phone calling in. It's line number 4.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Enjoying the discussion. I just had a quick observation, a comment, and then a quick question, and I'll ring off. I'm fortunate enough, I have 2 graduate degrees, and I can tell you that it was an awful lot of work. But I agree with your guest completely. Master's work is really a stair-step process. In other words, you know, you complete this course and you complete the next course and you kind of can see the light at the end of the tunnel. You know what's expected of you. The amount of dedication and the work for a PhD is really, I would say terrifying, but it's really a whole other kettle of fish. I mean, it really is a self-discipline, self-study, and it is what you make it. You know, a master's program, you know that if you do the work, you know, the next number of months or years, you're going to get a master's degree. The PhD is I think it just takes a whole other discipline direction, and again, the amount of work is daunting. So it's really rarefied air, and my hat really goes off to those people who can obtain that. My question was, given the amount of people who drop out, I'm just wondering from a historical perspective, given the fact that getting a PhD even now is fairly unique, you know, 100 years ago, you know, the percentage of those people who got into the program and those people that completed the coursework, I know it had to be a minuscule portion of the population, but I was just wondering, was there any variance between now and then as far as the number of people in and out of the program? And I'll go ahead and hang up. Thanks.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think your observations are really right on the money. People who do these degrees are extremely self-motivated and really learn to be incredibly autonomous, really good thinkers, and regardless of what career path they take, these are a set of skills and characteristics that are really, really valuable. The historical question, the first PhDs were granted in this country just at the end of the 19th century, and it was a very small part of the American educational enterprise, and higher education was a pretty small enterprise at that point. When we sort of start looking post-World War II, when there was really big expansion in American colleges and universities, and also at the PhD level, one of the things we see is that, again, to the extent that there are such data, the attrition rates are really remarkably stable, and it really has hovered in that 40 to 50% range, again, sort of aggregated across all fields, and it does vary among the fields. But that's been very stable through the whole second half of the 20th century.
All right, well, let's go to another call here. This line number 2, and the person is in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm. Hi.
This is really fascinating. When I was a doctoral candidate years ago, I really sort of entered it in a really naive sense, thinking, it was an art history, and I thought, I just love this field, and I was a studio painter, et cetera, et cetera. So I sort of just stumbled through it and over the years, and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did all this stuff. I ended up working in advertising, but I never will regret the knowledge I gained from it, and even though it was very bureaucratic, you know, the university format. But as you said earlier about it was sort of the humanities fields, it's actually a depression, in my opinion, because I know a lot of people have gotten doctorate finish their PhDs, and they're the, you know, the almost like the cliche taxi drivers. And it's very, very upsetting to see these people spend all this time and effort and not really able being able to find anything for their work. And I'm wondering if there's the university itself is at fault. I agree with you. It's systemic. The university itself is sort of feeds into this, you know, it's like numbers. They have so many doctoral candidates, have so many graduate schools, you know, graduate degree candidates, and then so many undergraduates. And, you know, the professors are mostly tenured, so what do they care? I really feel that way because when I was there, I mean, I'd been in the military and been in a combat unit years before, so the bureaucracy never really bothered me because, I mean, what if they weren't shooting at me, so I really didn't care. And I knew what I was doing, at least I thought I did. And, I mean, within my field, I really had no idea it was so bureaucratic. But I just want to, I really, really think your report is very, very important. And it should be, really, people should even know about this before they step into this. It's a real mess if you're not ready for it. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I think you've made just a lot of really good points that I'd like to respond to. And one really important one is I think that graduate schools at research universities around the country have really in the last 15 years had a shift in their emphasis and focus. And I think that they have really stopped seeing themselves as bureaucratic organizations, you know, with the ruler lady who made sure you had their margins right and would send you back to retype pages, you know, in the days before computers. But really now I think graduate schools see themselves in a student advocacy position, and a lot of graduate schools, and I think Illinois is one of them, have really tried to figure out how to both work with departments and work with students across the university to craft a set of experiences that really both combat isolation and help students make connections with one another, and to really think about what are effective practices that departments can adopt in order to facilitate student success and reduce the depression and the bitterness and the really negative things. And I really, my hat's off to a lot of those institutions that have been very forward-thinking in that. And one aspect of that is the career development question that the caller just raised. I think a lot of students, and again, particularly in the humanities, come to graduate school with a passionate desire to be a university professor, a college professor. They had a great teacher who inspired them. Someone said, you should do this. You are really talented. And it just seems like a really great life. And it is a great life. But there are not as many jobs as there are people receiving PhDs, and a lot of times I think students enter somewhat naive about the mismatch in that regard. That said, it's not, you know, career training, and nor do we operate in a system in this country that's centrally managed, as is the case in most other countries, or with professions like medicine, where there's very centralized systems of matching students to positions. And so, you know, there is kind of a gamble involved with that. But I also think it's really important for students to be quite proactive in pushing their departments and their universities to help them see the much broader range of careers and ways that they can contribute to be contributing members of society using the skills and knowledge that they earned, like your caller who was in advertising. And sometimes it feels like those paths are kind of invisible, and the more that alumni like that caller can be made visible and brought to campus and all of that, I think that's very important. And sometimes students feel like that's not supported in their department, and students need to take an active role in that. I think, you know, this really is, as one of your other callers said, about seizing hold of this and shaping your own destiny and not being kind of a passive recipient of the whole thing, but really saying, this is who I am, this is what I want, and by gum, I'm going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that also, it seems to suggest the question that this that kind of counseling is something that people could benefit from earlier in their university education, to the extent that if people, and again, it's not always easy, if people have some sort of idea what it is they want to do, then one, you know, they need to have someone sitting down with them and say, well, actually, maybe you don't need to have a PhD.
That's right.
To do this. So that, in fact, there may be people going into graduate education and maybe, in fact, they could be successful. It was not so much an issue of can they hack it or can they not, but that it doesn't, given their goal, what they want to do, that it's actually not necessary, maybe not the best thing. So maybe they really shouldn't be there. Again, I said not because they can't do it, but because it's not going to get them where they want to go.
Well, not to sort of be cold-hearted about it, but economists do talk about opportunity costs. And the choice to be in graduate school for 8 or 9 years in your 20s certainly has implications for your lifetime earnings and your ability to have a mortgage and buy a house and a variety of other things. So there are real trade-offs and choices, and it seems sort of cold-blooded to say, but I love art or I love history. Why do I want to think about that? But again, it's your life.
Let us talk with someone else. We have a caller in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had a university experience that was less than great. And a lot of the problems that I ran into as an undergraduate was not that I could not push forth and do the work, for I could push forth and do the work, but the work that I did was relatively meaningless. It all mattered who I knew, where I knew. It's the position to pull myself up from my bootstraps was not available. Simply because you are pulling yourself up from your bootstraps means that you are less than adequate for this program. And, you know, being bombarded with that attitude year after year after year was just a tremendous defeat. And I think the main problem with higher level education is that elitist attitude that you need to know somebody who's already in here to fully benefit from this situation. And I'd like to hear your comments on that.
I think you raise a great point, and I think, you know, again, in this country, we're in a really interesting position because, you know, I believe that our higher education system is probably the most democratic and most committed to access, possibly of any in the world. But that doesn't mean that the playing field is by any stretch level. And I think at the higher degree levels, it is certainly the case that many students come in who have a parent who has a PhD or have gone to Ivy League colleges and kind of have access or have sort of accumulated a set of resources and just understanding how to kind of navigate the system that's sort of internalized, that is much more difficult for someone who's a first-generation college, never mind first-generation PhD student. So I think both of those things are operating at the same time. And I think that's really challenging. And I guess that the challenge to prospective students and what I always try and say to prospective students is do a lot of hard question asking when you're looking at a prospective program. Talk to a lot of students. Figure out whether this is a place that's going to be a good fit for you. I think it's really easy to say, I'm going to go to the best place that's going to admit me. I'm going to go to the top college, the top university department that's going to give me the PhD, going to admit me and give me the PhD, and they look at a U.S. News and World Report ranking, or they ask an advisor who says, oh, if you can go into the University of Illinois, you'll have it made, or if you can get into Princeton, it's going to be great. But I think the question is that the right fit and match for that student? Is this a place where you're going to get the kinds of support you need? And that means you have to know yourself. You have to know, are you a person who really needs to be part of a strong and supportive community? Are you a person who just needs to be left alone so you can do your work? Do you need, I mean, and different people have different styles. So I think knowing yourself well and then doing as much inquiry as you can to find out if the place you're thinking about going is the right place for you is important. It's kind of, I guess today's Valentine's Day. It's like a dating situation. And the more you can find out about each other, the more likely it is to be a good fit and match.
I wish you were my guidance counselor. That information would have been really helpful in the high school setting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Questions, again, are welcome. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, so I should, again, introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes or more. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Chris Goldie. She is a senior scholar at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, where she's the research director for the Carnegie Initiative on the Doctorate. And she's done a lot of research on doctoral education, particularly the experiences of doctoral students. She was the lead author of a report that was published in 2001 titled At Cross Purposes, What the Experiences of Today's Doctoral Students Reveal About Doctoral Education. This was funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. And if you want to look at the report, you can go to www.phd-survey.org. She also is the co-editor of a book entitled Envisioning the Future of Doctoral Education, Preparing Students of the discipline, and that was published late last year. She'll be here on the University campus, University of Illinois campus, next week on Monday, February 20th, serving as the keynote speaker for an event titled Journeys in Graduate Study, Exploring Ways to Improve the Graduate Student Experience. This is sponsored by the Graduate College. It takes place from 1 to 5 in the afternoon on February 20th, and faculty, grad students, staff, and alumni are all invited to attend. All are part of the event. It's free, and if you want to find out information about that, you can go to the website of the Grad College. That's www.grad.uiuc.edu. And questions, of course, are welcome here on the program. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, it sounds as if certainly based on everything that we have discussed here and the information coming out of this survey, the one that was published in 2001, that a couple of things would be good. I mean, if we're interested in the idea of retaining more doctoral students, that is, keeping more of the people who start in all the way to receiving their degree, it sounds like a couple of things could be really useful. One would be at some point, probably even before they actually make their application to grad school to start into the PhD process, some kind of career counseling to try to help them get a better idea of what it is they want to do, where they want to go, what they want to study, what they want to do with it, you know, and do they need a PhD or in what do they need it or that sort of thing. And then, so that's sort of before people even apply. And then once people are admitted and then they actually start, it sounds as if they need some, maybe a little bit more mentoring or counseling or something like that from someone who is experienced and knows how the whole process works to try to help, in a sense, shepherd them through to, you know, to anticipate where the pitfalls and the roadblocks are and to try to help them so they don't end up falling in a hole somewhere and not completing where, if they had a little bit more kind of help, someone to sort of hold their hand, and not meaning that in a demeaning way, that they would have been more successful. So yeah. What sort of things are being discussed at where you are and in universities to try to actually do some of that?
Right. Well, I think that there's a couple of sort of good ideas that can kind of help us think about that. And one is, I think that one of the hallmarks of success is if students become integrated into an intellectual community. And kind of sounds like a buzzword, but if you think of an academic department as really an intellectual community, the first question is this a vibrant and exciting intellectual community that I want to be part of? So that's a question a student can ask or a prospective faculty member can ask when they're thinking about joining a department. And then the question is, what are the mechanisms that you can use at different points in time to help students become integrated into that? And then, of course, that makes it a much more exciting environment for everyone. So in the first year, what are the do students start in research early so that they can, right when they get there, so they can really understand what it means to be a historian or be a mathematician? How do people match up with their advisors? Do they get lots of information about each other and make sure their working styles match? Do they have an opportunity to kind of test and select that, or are they assigned to someone, or do they pick that as part of the admissions process? And then do you have all through your time, is there regular feedback where the student is saying, this is what I want to accomplish this year, this is how I think I'm doing, and they get good and candid feedback about strengths and weaknesses and things to work on all through their time, rather than the sort of, yeah, you're doing fine. You really want opportunities for kind of continuous feedback and opportunities to grow and learn and improve. And then are there ways to kind of stay connected with the community throughout, particularly in the dissertation writing stages, which, as we've talked about today, can be a really isolating and lonely time. But departments can really have mechanisms to do that, seminars and colloquia and expectations that advanced students are helping mentor newer students and that you really are kind of giving back now in the same way that other people helped you become part of that. So it's not just about faculty, but faculty and students are all part of a community and all have roles to play that are different at different points in time.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you sometimes get the sense that some people in academe are still back in this mindset that says, well, if by the time that you're starting a PhD, if you've managed to get that far, then you're sort of supposed to know what you're doing. You're just supposed to know. I think about the fact that, you know, that sometimes people, either graduate students or maybe even people who get their PhDs, are turned loose in classrooms. Yeah. And sort of the automatic expectation is that if you know your discipline, then you ought to know how to teach it.
That's right.
And that's not necessarily the case. I mean, there might be some.
It's rarely the case.
It's rarely. There might be some people that are somehow brilliant teachers out of the box. It was like they were born for it, but most people not. And yet we don't, for those kinds of people, we don't really put them through methods class. We don't teach them how to be teachers. We just sort of think, okay, you know your stuff, go in there in the classroom and tell the students. Well,
although I think that's really changed in the last decade. I mean, I have to say, I think that's really an area most colleges and universities have really tackled quite straightforwardly. And most campuses have, and I'm certain it's the case at Illinois, a Center for Teaching and Learning that works with graduate students. And I think it's really important in a department to have a set of teaching experiences where one moves to increasing levels of independence as opposed to, you know, sort of being thrown in from day one. And I think that really does happen more than it doesn't happen these days. Because I think you're right, that was a very big problem.
Yeah.
But I do think that that's a problem that nationally there's been a lot of attention paid to. Doesn't mean that it's where we want it to be, that it's as fully integrated and is given as much attention as it ought to be. But I think that it is something that people have been focusing on, I have to say.
Okay. Oh, well that's good. That's good. I mean, that's good. Maybe I'm a little out of the loop here on where it is with that. I guess I just know that in the past, certainly it's been a concern.
Sir.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with somebody else here in Danville, near not too far away here, line number 4. Hello.
I believe, David, you touched on my question, that is, what kind of experience would prospective PhD teachers be expected to have in any private or public college? Wouldn't they expect that person to have had some real life experience beyond just teaching methods?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that most colleges and universities that are hiring new faculty members have a strong expectation that the new faculty members have significant teaching experience and have had the opportunity to have some independence of instruction and have had some experiences with feedback.
What about life experience itself in the field that they're teaching?
Yeah, I think that really varies, and it probably depends on the field. A lot of doctoral education, there's still some assumptions that it's best to go pretty much straight out of undergraduate into a PhD program, maybe take 1 or 2 years off, but there's a lot of people that go pretty quickly from undergraduate to graduate and don't have a lot of opportunity to get life experience as a chemist, for example, or outside of a university setting. So I think that's an interesting puzzle.
And in fact,
you know, if programs were kind of made the assumption that it would be better for doctoral students to have a couple of years of life experience, it, I think in many cases, allows those prospective students to think a little bit more carefully about whether it is they really want to go to graduate school and what they want to get out of that, because they're comparing that to actual life out in the, if you will, real world, rather than just the, oh my God, I'm about to graduate, I better go to grad school because I've always been a good student and I don't know what else to do.
Can I ask one more?
Yeah, sure.
What about salaries, beginning salaries for a typical PhD in an academic field? What could they expect to realize?
Wow, that's a really good question. It varies quite a bit by discipline, but the salaries in many cases are really sort of shockingly low. I don't have those data at my fingertips.
Is it because of the proliferation of candidates?
It's about that, and it's about the real funding struggles that today's colleges and universities are under. I mean, I think that there's other people who are far more expert on this than I, but we really have spent the last 20 years kind of starving our colleges and universities, particularly at the state level, in favor of funding prisons or other priorities. And the amount of funding that comes from the state, I think we used to really believe that higher education was a collective good, that we all had a part of our social contract, and that was really important for us as a society to support that. And we've really moved away from that in the last 20 years. Most students now support their education on loans, which sort of assumes that it's a private good. I'm going for my own benefit, and it's not something that we as a society support. And the implications of that are there's not a lot of as much money for faculty salaries. And I think it's been a contributing factor to really shifting to a lot of part-time faculty members who are really paid a pittance in many cases, who might be paid $2,000 per course and have to cobble together a lot of part-time positions at different colleges and universities because full-time tenure-track positions have just been drying up. And it's part of a real complex ecosystem of the funding of colleges and universities. And I'm a little outside my field of expertise here, but it's a complicated problem, but I have to point some fingers at federal and state funding.
Good, thank you.
Thanks for that call. We will continue here. The next is Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. The University of Illinois has a really strong graduate student union, and kind of following up on this topic about salaries and specifically graduate students' access to healthcare and our living conditions, I'm wondering if you could just make some general comments about how you see graduate student unions fitting into the issues of attrition that you've looked at. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Okay.
It's been a very interesting phenomenon at American universities that in the last 10 years, there's been a rise in unionization among graduate students. And I guess I sometimes think about symptoms of problems. And in many ways, I think that the rise of unions has been a response to neglect and abuse. And I think that's really served as a wake-up call on a lot of campuses that students were in kind of dire situations, living at or under the poverty line, didn't have good access to health care, child care, at a time when you're in your prime family and childbearing years and with time to degree being 8 or 9 years in many fields and the need to go on and do a postdoctoral fellowship before taking a permanent position. This really was putting enormous pressure on a lot of students, and again, sort of the expectation that students fund their graduate programs by working either as research assistants or teaching assistants also sometimes can really slow time to degree, and the pay is not great. And I think unions really rose as a response to those kinds of sets of working conditions. They've been really good advocates on a lot of campuses for increased health benefits and better rates of pay. My office here at Carnegie is just up the road from Stanford University, and it's the second university in the country to now offer maternity leave benefits to graduate students. They just announced this about 2 weeks ago, and I think that sort of thing is a very important recognition that most graduate students are in a really at a time of life when that's really, you don't want to be putting people in a position of having to choose between bearing children and finishing their doctoral studies. And so, I really support increased benefits in that way. And I think unions have been part of that story.
We're coming down to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left. And I wonder, actually, if you wouldn't mind if I asked you about something completely different, as they say, although it's certainly related and something I would guess that you and the folks there had thought about. And I'm interested in your reaction to this story. Now, we've seen here some reporting on the last couple of days about a higher education commission that was named by the president to look at the issue of whether standardized testing should be expanded to colleges and universities. You know, now these days in elementary and secondary ed, the big buzzword and for a long time now has been accountability. You know, we somehow want to prove that students are learning. Mm-hmm. And with that, I guess one can understand that. That's perfectly appropriate. I guess I'm not necessarily raising the issue that that's a problem at that level. But I'm guessing that a lot of people at colleges and universities would say, now, wait a minute. Once you get to university, it's a different sort of a thing. And the idea of standardized testing for college students seems sort of strange. And I'll bet there are a lot of people who would say that it would be kind of strange. And I don't even know if we would be talking about even getting into graduate student level or how do we establish those? What those people have learned, it might be a little bit easier with undergrads. But do you think this is something there's going to be increasing pressure somehow on on higher education to address this whole accountability issue?
Oh, I think there will be. I mean, I think we've been seeing it coming, and there's been certainly pressures for accountability. Faculty members have had a lot of autonomy, and colleges and universities have historically had a lot of autonomy. It's, I think, one of the strengths of our system that each institution can kind of determine who they are and their own path individually. I think that we haven't always done the best job in higher education as to making the case for who we are and why we do things the way we do. And I think sometimes pressures for accountability are really kind of, tell me what you do, I don't understand. And it's a quest for understanding. That I guess that's the most sort of positive explanation that I can give for that. I'd have to be with the large bandwagon that's very skeptical about the usefulness of standardized testing, particularly at the undergraduate level. I don't think we know a lot about how to test really what learning is. There's some interesting efforts afoot nationally, and one would be the National Survey of Student Engagement, kind of known as NESE, which has really built on a lot of research about what it is that happens in a undergraduate college environment that does seem to be experiences that are highly correlated with learning. So, spending a lot of time with faculty members outside the classroom and number of hours students study, that sort of thing. And so this is a survey that several hundred colleges around the country, their students take to try and determine to what extent the experiences that they're having at that college are about students being engaged in the learning process. You're kind of hitting the limits of my expertise on this one.
Well, I understand. I'm sure that there are. If we wanted to talk about this, we could find somebody who has actually spent a lot more time thinking about it than you, but I expected you at least have something to say about it. So,
yeah.
Well, I tell you what, we are at the end of the time, so we will leave it here with, again, the mention that our guest, Dr. Chris Goldie, will be on the University of Illinois campus next Monday, serving as the keynote speaker at an event entitled Journeys in Graduate Study, Exploring Ways to Improve the Graduate Student Experience. That's from 1 to 5, Monday afternoon, February 20th, at the Illini Union. More information, you can go to www.grad.uiuc.edu. Our guest is senior scholar at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, where she is research director for the Carnegie Initiative on the Doctorate. And Dr. Goldie, thank you very much.
David, thank you. It's been delightful.